sweat a while, don't you think so?
No question. We don't have to send out. We don't have to send out a vice president.
We didn't. I would trust given them any advance.
No advice.
On this trip.
Took a bloody side, but we didn't.
But they didn't give them that.
And it's good to have the vice president.
How did they react in Australia?
You know, I haven't seen the reports. But,
I'm glad Pompidou is feeling good. We want him to win, Henry. Yes.
Oh, no question.
And he was pretty responsive. I remember how De Gaulle felt about this issue. Pompidou came along pretty far considering the left. The same is true of our Italian.
And did the same press conference in which he did that. And we have to say, he also said there are four states in Indochina, which I know I didn't like. And he wrote in this letter, which is what I had done in this letter. I sent in our fellow to his diplomatic advisor, and I said, look, you want Pompidou to know, we're not making a public statement. His crack at us in his press conference really hurt our relations.
You told him that?
Yeah. On the other hand,
for me,
I said, this
or
is
for me or for you.
I said, this is my interpretation of the president's feeling.
Oh.
I said, but I want you to know this. We have decided not to put the conference into Paris. Then the president thought about the situation, and if we could be assured that the conference would take place in a friendly atmosphere, that the French participation in it would be constructive for the sake of the long friendship he's had for France, and particularly for Pompidou, he might reconsider it. So they sent you a letter in which he said, now that the war is over, a whole new era will begin in our relation. This will be reflected in French behavior at the conference. Now, that's really very helpful to us. And I think we should send back a message.
Well, what are your plans now for the conference? I have supposedly kept up with
you. You're not meeting with the
caucus rooms.
Did you caucus rooms, Mr. President?
I think it's not that. It's going to be too much of an infringement on presidential prerogative if you go on the floor. I never thought of that. That's what I was speaking. I was actually thinking of several small meetings, but it's an irrelevant.
But that way we can avoid the small meetings, but it's in a caucus room.
Senate caucus room and House caucus room, right?
I suppose it's the caucus room. I know it's not on the floor. I suppose it's the caucus room. It's a room big enough to hold them. So it has to be the caucus room. It's from 1:30 to 2:30 for the Senate and from 3 to 4 for the House, with a half hour in between. The way I'll do it is I'll make a brief opening statement, 5 to 10 minutes.
Just make a question. Basically, just making, I think, just making 4 or 5 of the positive, tough points. This is at the beginning. We've accomplished our goals. Pointing out the difference between the you ought to particularly remember that you're there to not to reassure the doves, but to make the hawks feel that they support the right cause and that we accomplish something by sticking in there. We've got peace. The doves would have had peace for us or for the balance of we've got the right of the South being either by coalition or otherwise, and the right of the people to determine that right will never be compromised. And finally, we have the unconditional release of our prisoners. We have saved the honor of the United States. I think using honor, using words like that, is very good with those guys. Those guys are not all. has made major concessions. What the hell concessions did we make?
Really? What the hell did we concede?
It's a cave in our Vietnam.
It's a total cave.
And, anyway, I don't know. I hope our people, some of our people, write that way about, like, the...
Well, we got Joel Alcott called yesterday. He said he wants me to tell you it's the greatest diplomatic feat of modern American history. And he has now read the agreement. And somebody who has gone out there and left for it, this is a greater achievement than he thought possible. And, you know, Joel is a...
Fribbles. There were conscientious men that voted a public duty among them, just as there had been in the 18th century, to which tradition so many of them belong. Now speaking of Disraeli. Disraeli's rise was essentially a social rise, a conquest of London society upon which he made an impression for good or ill, seldom forgotten. The aristocracy has always been tolerant of individual oddities. It has been prepared to put up with entertainers, buffoons, jesters, and freaks as long as they give good value. Actors, writers, artists, and wits have never found it difficult to do what Disraeli unkindly described, the editor of The Times is doing, quote, simper in the enervating atmosphere of Gilded saloons. Disraeli certainly did not simper, but he was instinctively at home in the great houses. As he saw earlier, he had convinced himself of his own intrinsically patrician status, queer though this may seem. He prided himself on being a man of the world, cool, sardonic, urbane. It was the enthusiasm of Gladstone and his otherworldly indifference to the London drawing room which annoyed his really often times almost as much as his politics. The moral and intellectual problems which affect the greater portion of Victorian governing class were no interest to Disraeli. He was a very clever man, but like Derby, he was not an intellectual. He could feel for the wretchedness of the poor, but he could not feel for the moral anxieties of the prosperous intelligentsia. Quote, my lord, I am on the side of the angels, end quote. Thus to an audience of dons and undergraduates at the Sheldonian Theater in 1863, did he dismiss the whole controversy about Darwin's origin of species. The intellectuals detested him almost to a man. Who but Disraeli could have brought Freeman and Froude to denounce him from the same political platform?
Isn't that brilliant? It's just plain.
Yeah.
Say that you knew it. In fact,